So what do you think was the red juice that the woman had at the end?
Oh, I don't know.
You know, in that vial. And she rubbed it on her wrists?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Did you go all the way to the end of the credits on the last episode?
No, is there something after the credits?
In a world where you only have trailers and posters to judge a movie, Jim and Ted strike out to answer the age-old question, will you see it?
Ted, it's Jim.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
Good, how about you? I'm doing well.
A day late and a dollar short?
Well, both, right. It's episode 52.
Episode 52, again, another Saturday special.
Yeah, so we missed a Friday, but hey, it's Saturday and it's not 6 a.m., so I'm happy.
Yeah, you get a beer, you're ending your day, and what yeah. What do you have on tap today? Well, how do you want to do it? Do you want to do some beers? Do you want to do some reviews? What do you want to do?
Well, you started the beers.
Let's do it.
So I was in the store about a week ago, walked past the aisle, and couldn't help but think of Anne and her stomach problems that she's been having.
Uh-huh.
So I found Glutenberg, gluten-free beer.
Glutenberg.
You know what's funny? Glutenberg, you'd think it's like gluten beer.
Right. It sounds like it's Glutenberg.
It sounds like, oh, there's extra gluten. You know, give me a second helping of gluten with this beer. But it's gluten-free IPA, Indian Pale Ale, 6% alcohol. And I wasn't really sure. I mean, like, how do you, you know, as a brewer, how do you do it without, like, grain and the grain bill and stuff? So what they do is, well, number one ingredient, water, of course. Millet. I don't know what millet is.
Oh, it's a type of grain. It's like an ancient grain, I think.
Yeah, but it's gluten-free. It's not like gluten grain, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
buckwheat, corn, black rice, candy syrup.
Oh, my God.
Corn maltodextrin, hops, yeast. So let me crack this thing.
All right, let's hear it.
You know what I'll bet? I bet it's like got like minimal grain flavor or minimal malty flavor. Like, you know, some beers are kind of malty.
Yeah.
I bet I haven't even had one yet. You know, I've never opened one or had one.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee this thing is like so overhopped to like mask anything bad.
But all right, let's do it. Let's crack it.
Okay. Oh yeah, it's hoppy for sure. But and on the nose it is. Let me pour it here. Okay, I got it. It's a 16-ouncer too. So if I don't like it, man, I'm in. Smells good. It's smooth. Overall, it's really not bad.
Hmm.
Here, I'm going to give some to Clarissa. It's not bad. I mean, if Anne is into beer. And
Anne's not into beer at all.
Oh, well, too bad for Anne.
She won't be having the Glutenberg.
Yeah, and they also had a red ale.
Mm.
So I don't know how that is, but this, and it was like for a 4-pack, it was like $12 though. So it's not cheap, you know, it's not cheap. And
yeah.
Glutenberg is, let me see here where they're out of. You know, and then the funny thing is, it's like they put the label on the can crooked, but I think that's kind of the shtick. Oh, imported by Massachusetts Beverage. I don't know where this is even from. Brewed and canned by Brassers Sans Gluten. Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Montreal, Quebec.
Oh, Canadians.
Those Canadians, man. Those anti-gluten Canadians.
Always trying to one-up us.
Them and their healthcare and all that stuff. Jeepers. So what do you have tonight?
Well, tonight, so we had... another 2 weeks went by and we had another beer, a beer themed beer tasting at work. So it was another fun Friday.
Are you guys hiring?
always hiring.
Always hiring.
But this week was a red label. So anything with a red label. And for work, I brought that beaver. What's that belching beaver that you had? The peanut butter stout?
Yeah. So wait, when you say red label, you're talking about the label just has to be red and not something that's like marked down in the store.
They're creatives. They're visual people. They just said it has to look red because of the holiday season.
Oh, okay, sure.
So there are some red ales, some red IPAs, and my peanut butter stout, and a couple of peanut butter stouts. There was the Syntax peanut butter stout as well, which is also red labeled.
Did you like the peanut butter stout?
I liked the peanut butter stout. I think I liked the Belching Beaver better than the Syntax of the two. Syntax seemed like a smoother one, and it didn't. No, not smoother, sharper, like a like it was more one note, and the Belching Beaver was kind of smooth, and it just, you know, it was more of a personal preference thing. But because of that, I have this beer, I have a Modern Times, and it's not a red label, but it has some red in the label. I just sent you a picture of it, but you can see it right here.
Oh, there you go.
See? So Modern Times.
And that's a 16 ounce can.
They're out of San Diego, and this one has, it's called a nitrogenated miracle.
So it's going to be really frothy and like creamy.
Yeah. Resounding high five between our coffee and beer program, combining the nitro brown ale with the coffee we've roasted mere footsteps away from the brew house.
Oh, that's cool. So it's like a coffee brown.
Yeah. Along with a generous helping of coconut. So Anne's already, she's out for the beer, but she's not even doing coconut either. Expect a creamy, toasty, chocolatey delight, which sings with big, beautiful coffee and coconut notes, make the holiday gathering substantially more awesome. And I, you know, I picked this one mainly because of the label. I don't know if you saw that label is like an amazing graphic. It looks like it's from the 80s, you know?
I was going to say like 1970s Love American style TV show or something.
Oh, I think I should be wearing like a members only jacket.
Are you the only member?
We'll see. I'm the only person in this house that's going to be drinking this tonight. Hold on. Let me open it here.
I think nowadays anybody who has a members only jacket is probably the only member. Or they are a member. I'm not sure, you know, which.
All right. Yes. So it's alcohol by volume 6.2, IBUs 30, so it's very smooth. And what's final gravity? What does that mean?
So if it starts at like 1.085 on your hydrometer, and then by the time the final gravity finishes, it's like 1.022 or something.
Okay. So this is a 1.013.
Yeah, it's kind of irrelevant, really. I mean, it's just saying that it finished fermenting and you have alcohol. Because water is 1.0.
Oh, okay.
Right? So that's water is just one.
So the 0.013 is like the soul of the beer.
No, what that's saying is that's the 0.013 is a little bit of sugar left in it for like the sweetness and things.
Okay.
But the yeast did a good job in its efficiency to ferment most of the grain, of the sugar, I should say.
The 0.013 is the yeast poop.
No, that's
yeast waste.
No, yeast waste is the alcohol.
I don't know. I'm just...
And the CO2. All I could think the reason they say that is...
It's because they're nerds. They're beer nerds.
Yeah, I mean, or the person who cares is a beer nerd. And let's say it says, like, that's point, you know, the 1.013 versus 1.025. The 025 is going to be a little sweeter because there's still more sugar that didn't get dissolved, right? So it's going to be a little sweeter, a little maltier. This is probably a little bit lighter, probably not as sweet, if I had to guess.
Right. No, it definitely has some sweetness to it, but it's mostly in the aftertaste.
Yeah, and then you also have the coffee and coconut, you said, right?
Yeah, I don't taste the coconut at all.
Yeah.
The coffee just overpowers it, I think.
Would you recommend that beer?
Oh, I like it a lot. Yeah, it's good.
Oh, good. Okay, cool. Maybe I'll see if I can. And what's the make again?
The make is Modern Times. Modern Times beers out of...
Modern Times, okay.
Out of San Diego.
All right, I'm sure we could find some of those around here. I'll take a look.
There you go. There's a whole bunch of Modern Times, so check out their whole line.
Cool. Any news and noteworthy things that you've been up to or you and the family's been up to this week?
As far as us, we finally got to see Santa last night. That was part of the reason we had to shift it off of our normal Friday night recording.
How's he doing?
So he's all right. He's busy, you know, but still taking...
He's busy this time of year?
Taking time out for the kids.
Nice.
He was down at the Grand Californian, down at Disneyland, so we stopped by to see him, you know?
Yeah, he was at breakfast this morning where we went. Boy sat on the lap.
He gets around a lot, you know?
Yeah, I always was told that it's a bunch of helpers, but I don't know.
That's what it is, yeah. Santa's helpers, yeah. That's...
Is that what that is?
That's what goes out, because obviously he's way too busy at the North Pole.
Yeah, he's checking notes, checking them twice, and there's that whole thing.
I was surprised to hear that. I think it's a resounding, across the internet, it's a resounding thumbs up for this Christmas Chronicles. I'm a big big fan. I share my fandom of Kurt's new Christmas movie on Netflix, and I think everybody likes it. You liked it, right? You saw it, and you...
I thought it was really good, yeah.
You know, it's fun and fun to watch, and I think we'll be watching it again as the season progresses here.
I think tomorrow night we're going to do Polar Express, and then, yeah, we'll probably watch Christmas Chronicles one more time. It's like a modern classic.
Instant.
Instant classic, yeah.
Oh, and then I was on TiFo again last week.
Yes, that's true. Forgot about that.
I haven't had a chance to listen to TiFo yet, but I was there, so I know what was said. So I'll run in through and grab a clip of that.
And that was a Twitter conversation?
Yeah, so on the TiFo podcast, we had Matt from Next Best Picture, and we talked a little bit about film Twitter, about the upcoming award season that we're in or we're always in, and had a lot of fun. Just your normal stuff.
Yeah, cool. I'll have to check it out. I haven't seen it yet either. I knew you were on there, but...
Hey, we're busy. We're busy, folks. How about you? How are you? What are you doing this week? What did you do?
Yeah, so I started again, however you want to look at that. But I started a winter project of culling photos, organizing photos, both digital and like physical. I'm trying to, you know, I'm able to, with my Nikon, I'm able to hook up a tube thing and put a flash behind it. And I just take raw images of slides.
Oh, cool.
But I've tried it with negatives. It does work. It's just the negatives are a little cumbersome to work with. And then when I import them into Lightroom, which is the software I use, you just flip it from a negative to a positive in the tonal curve, and then you could see it, you know?
You invert it, right? Is that invert?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is you can't see what you're doing, so you don't know if the picture's worth your time to do all that work. So I always get like handicapped by the time issue. So I got an app on my phone that you just put the camera over. You look at it with the camera and it's flipping it, you know, from the negative to the positive. So you can just like run your camera over these images and you can see exactly what they are. Totally awesome.
Wow.
So yeah. And I mean, they're for the iPhone, Android, and you could just type into the search, just type in negative to positive film or whatever. And bam, there it is, you know, and like...
Oh, that's cool.
Hundreds of them. But yeah, I'm trying to get a handle on it because just pictures going back 100 years from my family, you know, like physical ones.
Mm-hmm.
And then my digital library is just out of hand.
There you go.
All right. So yeah, photos and Santa. That's been like the week. Or photos of Santa.
That's a full week.
So I want to throw out some Stitcher love this week. We've been reading iTunes reviews and it's a short one, but you know, hey, it's in Stitcher. So just letting people know that we have reviews in other places other than iTunes.
That's right.
And it's much appreciated. 5 out of 5 stars by Sean M. Callahan, C-A-L-L-A-G-A. H-A-N? Callaghan?
I think it's just Callahan.
Callahan? Okay. Title is Thoughtful. Great podcast with thoughtful insight from both hosts. Thanks, Sean.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a short, sweet, but like I said, I wanted to give some love to Stitcher this week, so that was the one on there.
Send that to me. I want to see if that's a Sean that I know.
Ah, okay. Okay, I will. Yeah, so he knows Ted, so we got the inside man.
I don't know. It could be a different Sean. You know, Sean Callahan, that sounds like a very common name, don't you think?
Well, especially if you're from Boston or something. And it's the Sean, like S-E-A-N, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be something Irish, right?
All right, so the beer, my beer is continuing to impress me. I love the coffee notes. I'm not a brown ale fan, so the coffee really helps it out for me.
I'm not a brown ale fan either. My friend Brian is, but
take it or leave it.
The thing about this beer, I mean, the thing about IPAs, like I said, I think it was last week, I said there's something like 660 some kind of hop, you know? And different hops do different things in your recipes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whether they're bittering and flavoring, aroma hops and all, whatever. So depending on which hops you're using and when in your boil and all that kind of stuff when you're making beer,
mm-hmm.
if you gave me this beer and just said, what do you think of it? I would never know this is a gluten-free beer.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. I mean, it's a little sweet, and that might be where like the candy... What is it? Candy... Syrup or something? Yeah, candy syrup. That might it might be a little sweet because of that, and they probably put that in there because they needed more fermentables.
Right.
But overall, though, I mean, yeah, it's smooth. It hits the palate nice. There's really no weird aftertaste. I mean, it's good.
Okay, so my last beer thing from this week. The best beer I had this week was Beechwood Beer 28 Haze Later. So Haze.
Beechwood Beer 28 Haze Later.
It's an IPA.
Okay.
It uses three kind of hops.
Sure.
It uses Citra hops, Mosaic hops, and I forgot what the third one was.
Never heard of it. I forgot what the third one was.
But it was so funny because I was like, ooh, I'm a Citra hops fan. I was like, I have been noticing that they're calling out the names of these hops now in the beers that I'm trying. And I'm a big Citra hops fan. And a lot of people were, a lot of the true beer fans were, they weren't poo-pooing it, but they were kind of saying, oh, that kind of, it makes us understand why you like the Hempinator or Hemperer, you know, because it's kind of that, the bouquet really hits you really strong with the Citra hops. And I was talking to Ash, my coworker, and he was talking about how he's a Mosaic fan. And I was like, oh, wow, now we're like fully defining ourselves by what hops we like and things like that. I was like, this is next level beer fandom, you know? So
okay, I figured it out. We create an app that logs all of the hops in all of the beer you drink, so then you can drill down to only that one beer you like.
Yep.
No variety in life. It's all everything gets drilled down to one podcast genre, one song music genre, one hop genre.
Right.
And that's how life works nowadays.
Right. It's not even a podcast. You just get to hear the same word over and over again because you like that word.
So yeah, that's how everything is, you know, like whatever the food is, you just put in like the ingredients, it finds that one common ingredient across all.
Cardamom is it.
Is that the one?
Cardamom, because it can be in food, it can be in beer. It can be in a podcast like right now.
I never heard of that.
We'll get you some cardamom.
I was thinking like tarragon or something, right? Like you're like, why is tarragon keep showing up in all my food? And then everything you eat has that. There's no variety left. I think we should write that app.
All right, cool.
Yeah, we can strip people of variety.
But we still have a little variety, so let's jump into some trailers.
All right. I like that. I like that. Nice segue. So The Umbrella Academy.
Yes.
So talk to me about The Umbrella Academy.
All right. So we'll have to talk about a little bit of a theme this week, but we'll do it at the end like we did like to. The Umbrella Academy.
Ooh, a theme.
Yeah. So I don't know. It seemed like fun. We know that Netflix is losing all of its Marvel stuff in 2019. And then this, I thought when I watched a teaser trailer, I thought it was a movie, you know, and I was fully expecting like a...
Wait, this isn't a movie?
I was expecting like a Watchmen type of movie, kind of tongue-in-cheek superheroes, right? And then as you...
Is this a series?
And when you drill into it, it's a series.
Oh, wow. I didn't do any research, but... I thought this was a movie.
Right? And it totally sells you like a movie. And I think that's the one thing that they could do a little bit better. So I know we do a little bit of exec notes, and I think we were talking about when Netflix did their overarching what's coming out in December. They did a decent job. There's something that we didn't mention. It says when it's a film, it actually puts film in the upper right-hand corner. So it'll say Netflix film or something like that when it's a film that they've helped produce or paid to have produced. Even if it's a Warner Brothers picture, like we'll see later on, but it's produced and executive produced by Netflix, then they'll put their name on it and put film up in the corner. But then for everything else that's Netflix, they call it a Netflix original. And I think that's where it kind of gets muddy because everything from a series to a comedy special is all labeled, all falls under this thing, this umbrella of Netflix original. So when you call something an original, it doesn't necessarily show that it's a series. And I think that's what this needs. This needs a little bit, I think it's a little more exciting to see something like this and to say it's a series because I love the 10-hour chunk. You know, when we talked about watching Maniac, that was definitely like a It's that mini series. It's the supersized serving of media content at a very high level, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that could give us a long time. Like, a movie has to condense everything into a two-hour, say, mean, right?
Right.
Whereas 10 hours, you elaborate more on the story and have more character development.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, I thought this, I truly did think this was a movie, because watching it, I'm thinking, wow, this looks really cool. Too bad I'm not going to go see it. And then at the end, they started like, they kind of like started writing out the end, and you could tell it was moving into the Netflix end. And I was like, whoa, on Netflix. Awesome. I'm going to go see this, or I'm going to see this.
You're like, my barrier to entry is so low.
Well, I mean, going to the movies is just such a hassle when you have little kids and stuff. Yeah. I mean, we've talked about that. I won't get into that anymore, but it's just a hassle, And on Netflix, though, you sit down on a Friday, a Saturday night, whatever, and boop, there you go. Even if it's, we could talk later, like we finished Homecoming, but you're talking 35 minutes an episode for Homecoming. I mean, how do you not watch it?
Yeah, it's too easy.
I mean, it's free at that point.
It's free, and it's not taking up the travel time to the to the theater.
Point exactly.
We saw The Favorite this week, so we did do some watching, a little bit of media watching, and Anne and I mustered up the energy to go see The Favorite on our $5 Tuesday.
Nice.
Got Frank and Barbara to help out with the kids, and them up from the Y after all of their activities. So we got to see The Favorite and we loved it. I think I fell asleep only once. So I think that's a ringing endorsement. If I only fall asleep once and we're in those big comfy chairs, I think that's an amazing feat.
Well, and the funny thing I notice about, the more we talk about these things, you fall asleep a lot to television and movies.
Yes.
it astounds me, because like you're so into it, yet you fall asleep all the time, which would be an indicator that this kind of sucks. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I said only once. So I was thinking as I left the theater, I said it ranks on the TED scale like as a 1Z, because I only fell asleep one time. So that's 1Z, which is an amazing rating.
1Z.
The
heck does that mean?
Like the Z's that fly off of you in a cartoon when you're sleeping?
Oh, those Z's.
Anyway, sorry. So the Umbrella Academy, I love the idea of it. I love the idea that Netflix is trying to develop original programming to replace a huge segment of programming that they're going to lose. They're in the process of both canceling shows and, losing them outright.
Let's get into some trailer critique. What are your thoughts? What'd you think?
I think my biggest critique is that it feels like a film trailer.
Yeah.
And I think there is a way to tease it out a little more. It's a teaser. Maybe that's part of the problem. I think there's got to be a way there's a way to show you that this isn't, because even in a series, I think the thing about a series sell or any kind of series promotion is that you don't sell it as an encapsulated story. You kind of sell it as an open-ended story. And I didn't get that this was open-ended. It felt like it was very finite in what it was trying to do. So even though it's a series, we don't know if it's a limited series or if it's something they expect to go year after year. So that's still kind of, it's ambiguous in the way that it's sold to us here.
Right. And I didn't know that was a critique for myself until just now that I learned it was a series. And I agree as far as open-ended versus close-ended. Generally speaking, even if it's a movie, they might not give away the whodunit or whatever, but going into it that it's a movie. So what if they would do something like right in the open and that tells you this is a series? I mean, I don't know, in a clever way.
No, I say do it ham-handedly. I say put Netflix series in the top corner and let it...
Exactly. That's what I mean.
Let it play out, yeah. I don't think that's clever, but I think you just say it flat out, and they're not hiding it. And I think when we talk about the critique, we say it's a critique, but it's very minimal, because like you said, once you see Netflix, you know that your ability to access it becomes so much easier, that they don't have to be a hard sell on whatever it is. Even if you tune into it and you think it's a movie and yet it's a series, it's just gravy. It doesn't make a difference. You wanted to sit down for 2 hours and then it's a series, but they release them in series chunks. You can binge any amount that you want to binge at a time. And then you go from there.
Yeah, and that's like Buster Scruggs. I didn't know that was, I thought it was going to play out way different than what it did, and it was just a bunch of disparate stories. That's all it was. And they didn't sell it that way, though in hindsight, looking back at it, yeah, that's, they never showed the characters' stories intersecting.
Yeah.
You just assumed that they would at some point, but...
And then when they didn't, you're like, eh.
Exactly. So this might be an argument for the 80s, 90s version of trailers where you have the voiceover guy telling you everything.
Right.
In a world of a Netflix series.
Yeah.
Come six teens who are one of 43, but nobody knows what happened to the other 37.
Right. Right, right. It's awesome.
And speaking of that, 43 women give birth on the same day that they conceive.
Right.
Six get adopted and become like these superheroes. But where are the other 37?
I think those have to be the villains, right? That's, isn't that the, maybe those are the villains.
I see, yeah.
And then you spent the whole time in the series like either turning or defeating the other ones.
So you're outnumbered like 4-1.
Yeah, you're heroes. You're heroes. You can do it.
But then, like, think about that, though. I mean, it's like 43 Jesuses. You know? I mean, and that maybe that's why they have superpowers.
Yeah.
Like, well, one of them can walk on water. The other guy, like, heals lepers.
Wow, you're really getting heavy into the Christmas season, huh?
Yeah. And, you know, well, like, instead of, like, one Jesus doing all these... like superpowers.
Yeah.
You have 43 superpowers, but each is done by one person.
There you go. Yeah, that's right. Different person.
Or a different person, if you know what I mean. Yeah. But I have to say, too, the sound score, you got to love yourself some Tiffany. You know, I mean, brought you right back. I mean, 89. It's at 89. I graduated high school in 1989.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm an old.
Every time, I think you're older, and then you're not that much
what?
Older than me.
My God, man, Jim, you just like, wait, you're 47. I could have swore you were like in your 60s. No,
it's all that biking. It keeps you so young.
I guess keeps my waistline trim. So what do you think is in the name, the Umbrella Academy?
I don't know. I mean, to me, it just screams of like X-Men and Xavier, you know, Xavier Academy. It just has the same iambic pentameter of, you know, Umbrella Academy, Xavier Academy. It just has the same rhythm to it.
Yeah, it's just like a play on words, I guess, right?
I think. I'm sure it has a meaning, but I think when they were brainstorming it, they said Xavier Academy, Xavier Academy. And then they were like, what can we do something like that? And then they came up with the Umbrella Academy. But who knows?
Did you get the feeling that based on what they're talking about, everybody should be roughly 30 years old, right?
Yeah.
Depending on like whatever date they were born for when this gets released.
Right, right.
But let's say 30 years old. The characters, though, some of them look younger, some of them look older.
Right. I mean, those superpowers, they do different things to different people, I'm sure.
Yeah, I guess you can always explain that away. I don't know. Or, yeah, I mean, they're divine. I don't know what to say. The one scene was cool. It was kind of like Hitchcock's Rear Window, where they had the building with all the different like channels going on. It was like a quick kind of a hit.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and each room essentially could be like a different like TV show playing out or something.
Yeah, that would be cool. I think
that was kind of how Hitchcock did Rear Window.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're looking at a time when television was beginning to take the space of going to the movies, and each of those, like you had the dancer, you had the murder mystery, you had all these things. They were all like TV shows,
mm-hmm.
You know, and Jimmy Stewart would sit there and like kind of watch them all like as if he was changing channels and stuff.
Yeah. Does it feel like they were also attacking some of the Tarantino stuff? Did you have a Tarantino vibe throughout there a little bit?
I did not. Tell me where you thought of Tarantino. I'm curious.
So there's a couple of scenes. There's one that's like a trunk scene where they're wearing masks and they open a trunk and it's out of the shots out of the trunk. And Tarantino loves the trunk shots.
With like those clown masks,
yeah,
and all that? Yeah, 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 yeah. I got it now.
And then immediately after that, they do a little bit of gunplay and the guys are in suits. It's a chick in a suit, black suit with a black tie and a white shirt, you know, which has a little, that feels a little Tarantino. It feels a little Pulp Fiction to me. So I think I because of that, I thought of Tarantino, but then I also thought after reflecting on it, I thought of the way we said Maniac kind of has Tarantino elements in it, Coen brother elements in it. And it feels, now that we know that it's a series, maybe they're going to do this cool thing where we talked about Maniac did it, where you have stories that arc over different episodes. So as an episode ends, the story doesn't have to end. The story can take any amount of time between an hour to 3 hours. And we'll take one story and we'll span it over 3 episodes, and that'll be okay. And we could tell up to 3 to 5 stories in this 10 episode arc, and we don't care where the episode ends. We're going to let the story play out as if it's a movie or whatever space and time it needs. And I watched the second episode of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel this week, the second season of it. And they do the very similar thing where they have a part that's in Paris and it lasts for 2.5 episodes or something like that. And they have a part that's in the Catskills and it lasts for 4 episodes. So I think the idea that stories have to be tied to the duration of an episode has completely flown out the window, because now Netflix and Amazon both do stories that take their time.
Yeah, and that goes back to what we were saying. Like, a movie has to be concise, you know, and drill it all down to 2 hours, where, yeah, you can do character development over a few periods or a few episodes, a few seasons even. I mean, I don't know, but I guess the last thing I want to say about it seems like it's a lot of fun. You know, even though the Earth is ending, I mean, they don't take themselves too serious. You know,
what's the point of that? If you take it so seriously, you know, the world ends either way.
Yeah. I mean, it's like when the world ends, it's like, meh, whatever. Like, I'll just go get another beer and ride it out. What else are you going to do? Cry? I mean, I guess I will. I'll probably cry in my beer.
There you go.
Anything, any final comments?
No, I think that's it for me.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's move on to Brightburn.
So I was super excited about Brightburn.
Again with the trailer to the trailer.
So the trailer to the trailer. I will forgive that. I just am excited that James Gunn is back in the saddle and helming a project.
Jimmy Gunn.
And did you see Hancock back in the day?
I did not see Hancock.
So Will Smith did a superhero movie that was directed by Peter Berg. You should definitely check it out. I think it's underappreciated. But he basically plays a drunk, recovering superhero. And he's a superhero, but he doesn't want to be a superhero. So he becomes an anti-hero way before Deadpool, at least the filmic Deadpool. So Will Smith plays Hancock, and he basically flies around and he doesn't remember what he's doing or why he is the way he is. And to this, this is, you know, as people were talking about this Brightburn, everyone was saying, well, I guess we know now what Superman would be like if it was a horror movie, or if Superman chose evil over good, you know?
Yeah, and that, in my notes, I have the story play is a play on Superman or origin story, but for evil instead of good.
I read your notes.
Are you looking at my computer? No, is there a camera over my back?
You cleaned your glasses so I can now see the reflection in your glasses.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So you see the reflection, you hold up a mirror to reverse it back again. They got your scheme.
So, yeah, I think, you know, James Gunn, he loves these kind of anti-hero superheroes. He's played with it in his earlier films. You know, he jumped into the big, big money game of Guardians of the Galaxy, had good, you know, good character development, good just fun with that franchise. And now, you know, as he's dusting himself off from getting, you know, the boot over there, this really comes into show his strengths. It's a little darker, I think, than his other stuff. You know, it's billed as a horror. Screen Gem is definitely a horror production company. So, you know, the production company has its own halo that it's casting over this production, and it has that jump scare at the end for you. Sorry to ruin the trailer if you haven't seen it.
I was going to mention, I'm just glad that they didn't tell me to watch it to the end.
Because you know I wouldn't stop talking about it.
Right. You know, I mean, it was very like Nun-esque at the end there. And yeah, I was a little surprised at, you know, the way it kind of played out. But I didn't know who the kid was, and I knew nothing about it. And when I watched it, and then he attacks the woman in the
freezer.
Produce yeah. cooler, freezer, whatever that is. It was shocking. It's like, well, wow, why is he like after her, you know? But I think it's a typical modern day trailer. I mean, you have the trailer to the trailer. It's all the trailer tropes, yep. right? And then it has like the calm beginning. And then there's like...
Has your legacy cell with James Gunn directing, you know?
Yeah, the ship comes crashing in. That's the turn. Then everything starts changing, you know, and it all hell breaks loose. Yeah, very typical, I think, of the way trailers kind of play out nowadays.
Yeah. I think, am I right that she doesn't repeat the trailer to trailer segment later? Elizabeth Banks doesn't say that later in the trailer, right?
I was looking for it. I didn't hear it, but but I was probably jumping because of the jump scare at the end.
It threw you off.
I was waiting to watch to the end because the nun told me I should always watch to the end.
So now you just watch the end anyway.
Yeah.
So I was wrong. I guess this is produced by James Gunn.
Ah, the producer, not the director.
And you know, the funny thing is that they play on you. And when you recall it, now I know why I thought that. Because there are two cards. There's the first card. It says produced by James Gunn, right? And then they show another shot, and it's a shot of the wheat fields or whatever. And then they cut back, and it says the director of the Guardians of the Galaxy series. So they even use the name of the series that he was the director of. So they call him out as a director of a separate series, and yet they've only called him a producer of this. But, you know, as you're watching something, you're keeping it fresh. You're trying to keep it all straight in your head. And even me, where I'm trying to watch it very critically, I was left with the idea that because the last card I saw was director of Guardians of the Galaxy, my associative brain just said, oh, well, he directed this, not having dug too deeply into the IMDb page on this. Because I know who I know who Elizabeth Banks is, and, you know, I'd watch her read a phone book, so...
Yeah, I could see how, as you watch it, how that gets you to the point where it leads you to believe that he's directing. Because like you said, you're watching through it. If you just happen to be watching non-critically, you're just seeing like, oh, let's see what this movie's about. We want to go see it. You watch it quickly. You're thinking like, there's Jimmy Gunn and he's directed the one thing and he's producing and who knows, you know, and you just, yeah, you get lost in there of what he's actually right. doing and who is directing if you don't bother to look right. it up. So totally gets lost. I agree. So Brightburn, I don't have much else to say. It looks a little freakish.
You're not going to see it.
I'm probably not going to see this one. Is this a story that you're familiar with?
No, I like it looks like it's a total play on Superman. It even all the way down to the logo of the Brightburn, the BB, looks kind of like the S on Superman's chest. So
yeah,
I definitely want to see it. I'm definitely going to see it. We'll see when I see it, probably streaming.
All right. Let's move on to Triple Frontier.
All right. Tell me about Triple Frontier.
All right. So Triple Frontier. I did some research trying to see if this was a true story or something, and it's too hard to find out. There's not much talking about it. A few people ask the question like in Reddit and stuff, but no one really has any answers. When the opening scene, they get to that container, they open the container, my initial thought was, ooh, Delta Operation. That was like a Delta Force movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know, Ben Affleck, is he believable as like a Special Forces team leader?
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because it's, you would think that Oscar Isaac he's the lead of this show, and yet Ben Affleck is the bigger draw as far as, you know, for whatever your IMDb star meter score or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
So the thing that made me think of was Three Kings. You ever see Three Kings?
Oh, yeah.
So Three Kings has that same Clooney, you know, it's a lot different. It feels a lot.
Wasn't that Ice Cube?
A lot more tongue in cheek. Marky Mark. Hey, funky bunch. But yeah, this has the same kind of feel where they go in for a heist, but it's not the desert. It's, you know, South America or Central America or something like that. But I like the ensemble cast. It felt like a great pull to pull in all these actors from, you know, one from block, you know, two from blockbusters. It's like an X-wing fighter pilot, a Batman, you know, and it's just amazing international cast, a son Son of Anarchy, right? Isn't that the other guy?
You know, I think with the characters and all the different movies you were talking, along with the legacy card that they have, you know, Most Violent Year, Wonder Woman, Dark Knight Trilogy, as far as producers, directors, and everything, I mean, you know, they're dumping a lot of money into it.
So much money.
Yeah, I mean, is a major heist something you could see yourself doing?
No.
No, not even. Okay, let me classify it a little different.
Okay.
Maybe not like as a special forces operator, right?
Right.
You know, where you're going with weapons and stuff. But let's just assume you go clandestinely somewhere, like, I don't know, we'll just say into Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
You sneak in illegally, you know, you fly in under the radar, you know, helicopters, whatever. But you get there and you start managing like media content for their local Mexican soap opera studio.
Yeah.
For, you know, to take millions back home, like to send Audrey to college,
yeah.
Right? The thing is, though, you can never live your life that you live now again because you're on the lam from your current major studio employer because they're out to get you. Because you're in direct competition and in violation of your contract.
Uh-oh.
Doing Mexican soap operas.
This is all fake, by the way, just so everybody knows.
Well, it's a scenario. I'm saying, would you ever do it?
Hypothetically speaking, yes.
Hypothetical, would you ever go
yes.
on a clandestine Mexican soap opera heist to bring back $70 million to send Audrey to college?
Yes, because it would send both Audrey and Bryce to college.
Okay.
$70 million? That's my cut.
And it would pay our hosting fees.
That's my cut, right?
Well, that's the whole thing.
That's the whole thing. So how many people are in this heist? Seven?
Well, maybe you get some of your office mates because you got to go in and you're like, we don't have the logo on our back on this one.
No, right? No ears on this one.
Yeah. You got like everything what they say. It's like, you know, I took six days and I can't even send my daughter to college. So I'm going to go down there and get the millions.
Yeah. Cash in, man.
No?
Totally. Yeah. I'd do it.
Okay. Okay. And you and like your cubicle dwellers
right.
go down there.
I just take my legion that I'm really close to.
That's right. It's everybody just jump ship. And next thing you know, you're like,
we could drink all the craft beers we wanted.
You take Mexican soap operas to the next level.
Yes.
And that's how the money comes in.
So I think my cut would be like $7 million. That's worth it.
Let's say seven. Okay, let's say, yeah, $7 million tax-free.
Yeah, that's
cash.
Worth it.
But how do you spend it, though? That's
very, very slowly.
See, that's the thing, though. So, okay, these guys come away with $75 million, whatever's in there, right?
Yeah.
They come away with the money. They go back to where, I don't even know where they go. But what do you do with that kind of cash? It's not like you're going to go make a deposit and be like, oh, now I could just like charge shit on my credit card and pay it off every. I mean, like,
well, we'd send you to Copenhagen. You'd buy Urban Arrow and then invest in De Beers. You buy some diamonds, sell some diamonds. You know, I'll go to Deutsche Bank. We got this. We got the laundering down. I think I could figure out how to launder
okay.
$70 million.
Yeah, yeah. Not, it's not a car wash though,
no,
is it?
No, not a car wash.
Or Glutenberg?
No, we'd establish a Czech German brewery.
I like that.
You do it in Europe, and we'll do a Frankfurt
yeah.
brewery and Austrian brewery and a Czech brewery.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, okay. Well, let's start planning. And then when we podcast, we'll just have to let everybody know that like we're not at home and we're at some undisclosed location.
Yes,
around the world because the ears are after. After us.
And people just have to deal with the hot tub bubbles from our Austrian getaway Alps.
Hot tub bubbles. Man, this guy's... So I love the scene where the guy's hanging from the burning MI-17 Russian helicopter.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm bringing out some of my cavalry reconnaissance training.
Some air cav?
No. So in the army when, like, you know, I did reconnaissance stuff,
uh-huh.
you know, as a cavalryman, you have to know, like, when you're calling back, like, oh, I see, like, you know, a T-72 in the open, you know, whatever, like Russian tanks and stuff. Well, you got to know what all the different, like, countries, whether it's, like, ours or German or Russian or whatever. So like if you call in artillery, you're not blowing up like friendly people.
Yeah, you got to know friend from foe.
So yeah, we just, you know, we had to memorize all these different vehicles. And I just, when I saw it, I was like, oh, Russian helicopter.
I'm glad to know your training has served you well.
Yeah, I still remember some of that stuff. Amazing, amazing. But yeah, it looks cool. I mean, they, like I said, they dumped a lot of money into it. I don't think Netflix is at the point where they're sparing any expense. It got me thinking, where is Apple and A24 going to fall into some of this mix? Because Netflix is bringing the hammer down. Amazon's putting a lot of money into Homecoming. Well, not just Homecoming, but I mean other content they have.
They got Jack Ryan. They got Homecoming. They got Mrs. Maisel. They have the Romanovs. They have tons of stuff.
Tons of stuff. Yeah, the Romanovs looks cool. Again, a laundry list of actors. So, I mean, you got to pay these people and the high production value. So, I mean, all these companies, and heck, Bezos is probably writing checks for actors out of his own checking account. You know, isn't he like the richest guy in the world right now, or something?
Yeah, Amazon definitely has our money. I mean, we're you know, Santa's buying through Amazon. Everybody's buying through Amazon. You know, it's super easy.
Hey, the North Pole delivered today from Amazon.
So you finished Homecoming. Let's start there.
Yeah, we finished Homecoming. So psychological super soldiers.
Right.
Yeah, go off to war and just do whatever. Come back. We'll wipe your memory and send you right back in a quick turnaround.
Oh, you think they sent them back into war?
That was the whole purpose.
Oh, that was what he was selling at the conference.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I missed that part. And I didn't sleep at all during this thing. I was awake the whole time.
Yeah, so what they were doing was they were coming back. They drugged them through the food. It wiped whatever PTSD-inducing memories they would have had. And then right back, turn around. Because that's, if you recall, Cruz, the guy that was like the main soldier guy that she was close to, he was talking about like, yep, I'm going back. It's my job. But, you know, I'm going to be there one more time. And I can't wait to get there. I'm happy to go. I'm going to do my, you know, I'm going to do my job.
Do my part. Yeah.
Do my part. Yeah. So then he was going to go. And it was like this turnaround over and over. And then, you know, I think it was to alleviate like enlistment, you know, you don't have to keep enlisting people and then.
Oh, right.
So you could just keep reusing, you know.
So that does make the ending more meaningful. I thought the ending was kind of ambiguous because she had basically tried to wipe her own memory, right?
The way I read that is she took one for the team because she gave him a double dose, which then made him useless.
Right.
So I think she took one for the team in that I know this is going to mess me up, but I'll be okay. This way he doesn't have to go back and potentially get killed.
Right. And then in the end, in the diner where he's coming in and talking about his porch and how he might never finish his porch, and he's kind of joking with the waitress there. And even though she's not interacting with him, it was never too... I like that their relationship never became a romantic relationship. There's innuendo and...
There were hints here and there, but you're right. I'm glad it didn't. I think that would have ruined the story.
I think it properly went the path that it needed to go. You know, she had the dalliance with what's his name, you know, her boss or whatever. So it had some of that. It had the elements to alleviate that tension, romantic tension or sexual tension in the show. But then for her to have a pure of heart and mind connection with that soldier was amazing. And then just... It was very, like, subdued to show her just smiling in that super close-up to know that he's just living out his life, building a porch. And basically, their interaction, their sessions together had brought something out in her and gotten her out of her comfort zone and made her available to travel cross-country, something that she didn't think of doing, you know, on her own. So I like that element, too.
Yeah, for sure. And then did you get the sense of, like, with the editing and the directing and so on, like kind of like a Hitchcock sort of like, you know, it was like a Hitchcock film in many ways.
It had many elements. I think when, because Sam Ismail was the director and producer of this, and I think because he wasn't the creator of it, and because this came to him as a fully formed audio broadcast creative conceit, he had to really like make it interesting for himself and develop develop, you know, the conventions, like the square convention versus the regular 16:9 convention, you know, aspect ratio. Did you watch that special feature yet?
No, I haven't seen that.
Oh, okay. So basically he...
Honestly, I completely forgot about
it. No, it's cool. He basically talks about walking around with blinders on. And he goes, when we go to the flash forward, because she has done the double dose of, on herself, she basically doesn't have her full cognitive memory of what's going on. So to express that visually, they put all of her future scenes in this square aspect ratio. And as she basically overcomes that hurdle in her cognitive memory, her vision expands to kind of take the blinders off. And by the end of the movie, by the end of the season, it expands to the normal 16:9 aspect ratio. And that is the point in the story where we know that she has regained her cognitive ability.
And I think that one of the things there too is kind of like that, what would you call it? Like the pole zoom effect or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty Hitchcocky.
That the Hitchcock shot, yeah.
Yeah, and when the camera's on the back of the car as they're pulling into the parking spot, you know, and it's very static.
A lot of camera work was very reminiscent of Hitchcock.
Yeah, I love that.
That over-the-head shot, the shots that follow, like you said, the shots that are locked onto the cars as they're going. It's a well-crafted work that definitely adds to the audio play that it was before.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I like the premise of the story. I could see government operations attempting something, you know, where they want to make people, I don't know, like, I don't want to say wipe memories, but make it more easy to deal with. So as you continue to go back and get redeployed over and over, they don't, you know, people don't have psychological breakdowns and so on. However, I can also see once the lid gets taken off of this thing, like by the media and stuff, and somebody exposes it, like, it would just be, I mean, the lawsuits would be flying, the controversy, you know, something like this I don't think would ever happen, though. The liabilities would just be way too great.
It wouldn't happen in the open, that's for sure.
No, exactly. But what I'm saying is, though, they would do it clandestine, they would do it under wraps, but there's too many people, I think, you know, in the government and in development of a program like this, it would get out. And then once out, it would just, I don't know, but how do you get testimony, though? Because everybody forgot.
Yeah.
You know, I'm serious, you know, like, you know, and with the few people at the top who won't talk about it.
Right. And because they would burn for it, that's for sure.
Yeah, it'd be like Ollie North with plausible deniability.
Oh, Ollie North.
So what do you think was the red juice that the woman had at the end?
Oh, I don't know.
You know, in that vial. And she rubbed it on her wrists?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Did you go all the way to the end of the credits on the last episode?
No. Is there something after the credits?
Yeah.
Oh, I got to watch that.
Yeah. So you were in the room when he was getting the guy who worked for Geist. He was like getting fired or whatever, right?
Uh-huh.
Or he was signing that like form.
Yeah.
So the credits rolled. And went back to that scene, and then he signed the papers and left.
Uh-huh.
And she goes into her purse and pulls out a vial, and it says like something to the effect of for lab use only or something. And she rubs her wrists as if like how a woman puts perfume on her wrists, you know?
Yeah.
She does that, and then you see her like put it back, and she does like a sigh of relief, like, oh, like I just had my fix.
Oh, I guess it's setting up another season. We'll see what that's all about.
Yeah, I know. I was like, what the heck is this now? Yeah, it was like a quick, I don't know, 10-second thing right at the, maybe 20-second thing right at the end.
Oh, I got to tune back in because I was so used to them like cutting off the credits and like showing me the next episode that I just didn't even sit through the credits.
See, I always sit through them all. You know, because I've learned the hard way, like even we go to the movies and stuff, I'm like, you know, you go to see like a dusty crop hopper.
Planes.
Next thing you know, you go through all the credits and you do all the thing, and then they show the old or the guy who was doing running the lodge and fire and rescue, and there he is in like the hottest, you know, like Death Valley or whatever. So yeah, I mean, from all those movies, you got to watch to the end. You know, but that's a good point, though, like in a series, and I think they played it right. If you did it like at the end of every series before the next episode started, that would be weird, you know, but to end the season that way, I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. So here's my news for you, because we were talking a little bit about news and we're talking about the scripted series. I guess every year FX does an annual report and they release it publicly on how many scripted series there are in a calendar year.
Like across all platforms, all networks?
Exactly. All platforms, okay. All networks. And it kind of gives a great trend line of how things are being produced. So over the past 3 years, so 2016, 2017, 2018, the number of scripted programs has gone up. All right, so 2016, the number of scripted series was 455. So it went from 455 scripted series in 2016 to 487 in 2017. And then this year, it's 495. So that's interesting, right? It looks like it's still trending upwards, not as much from last year to this year. But the big takeaway from this report is that for the first time, streaming shows have overtaken basic cable and broadcast. So it's kind of a huge thing that people are saying is a significant indicator of what's to come.
Well, let me clarify really quick.
Yep.
So is that the viewership of streaming, or the number of streaming shows are more than the networks and cable?
No, we're just talking about programs.
Okay, so gotcha.
Out of that 495, there's a cool graph in here. 160 of those are online services, 146 are broadcast services, and basic cable is 144.
Wow, that's a lot of acting, producing, directing, lighting, cameraman. I mean, so the industry as a whole, and that's just series though, right? That's not movies?
That's just series. Yeah, movies isn't even taken into account. And that's why,
okay,
you know, when I talk about film Twitter, and I do like lumping all of media together, because to me, this television space, the linear broadcast television or scripted series space, is the most interesting, because it has this huge sea change in the way that people consume it, and the way it's produced, and the way it's paid for. You know, you would have a handful of production companies making a handful of shows for a handful of broadcast companies. And there's a lot of overlap, you know, like we've talked about before. ABC could make shows that would show on NBC, and they'd handshake, and they'd both make money on it. And it was very similar to the way Netflix started. When Netflix started, they partnered with ABC Studios and made Marvel television style series like Daredevil. But then it, you know, as that relationship ran its course, it's different now. It feels like the walls are coming up. And I kind of liken it to the idea of the old studio system. You know, the old studio system kind of owned the actors, for lack of better explanation. You know, when you talked about the way that movies were made, the studio would hire an actor, and that actor would work in the studio's movies, regardless of what the movies were, right? So you had very little say in what you were going to act in as an actor. And as they realized that actors could break away and actors could make the deals directly with the production companies, but on a movie by movie basis, it really turned the tides, and it made the actor a much more higher paid commodity of the whole system.
Yeah, I got a few things I think about. I mean, so it seems like when you look at series like this and you look at the democratization of the internet, podcasting falls in there, and I mean, YouTubers, and I mean, there's so much, you know, vloggers, I mean, whatever it is, there's so many people putting out content, whether that's from just written work like blogs, websites, people writing, people, you know, creating content, whatever the content is. And it's so, there's so much democracy involved, that I think the bottom players, or the bottom 50% for sure, there's so many people, or, well, let me back up. If you look at the bottom of the monetization side of it, right, you're probably looking at like 90% of all of that, all content that's democratized across the internet, 90% of it, there's probably not much money. Most of the wealth in content creation is probably in the top 10%. So top 10% kind of blogs, podcasts. What did you call it? It's what kind of marketing is or media is this? Scripted?
Scripted, yes.
Yeah, scripted.
Scripted original series is what FX Networks research calls it. Estimated number of scripted original series.
Okay, so when you look at all of this stuff, to include movies too, our attention is so divided because every year, and what you said was, I mean, you're looking at 50 more shows coming out in 2 years' time. Every year, more and more content. I mean, I listen to podcasts all the time, and there's podcasts advertising for podcasts, and there's podcast yeah. networks. I mean, podcasting is booming, and blogs have kind of fallen away a little bit. I think the blog thing has, of the early 2000s sense, blogs, it's not just streams of consciousness that people would write. Now they're more like, you know, websites about, like, you know, like almost networks in and of themselves. And, you know, you look at something that may have been a blog like Life Hacker or something, and now all of a sudden it's like a whole network of writers and, you know, that bring all these people under their umbrella that write for them.
Yeah, if you're successful at blogging, then you've become a network of bloggers, of people, of basically a new kind of news media. You know, Nerdist, Vox.
Yeah, so when you look at that, there's so much competition, and all these different media companies, they're putting out so much content that our attention is so divided that most people putting out all this content are doing it for the love of doing it, hoping one day they might make money, but the reality is most aren't going to make any money.
Yeah, exactly.
And I would even say that's true for scripted content. I mean, nobody could ever watch 500 different episodes or a series, let alone all the episodes that are involved, you know. And even if it is on Netflix, I remember when Netflix put out its first original thing, which was what, House of Cards or something, if I recall. Wow, their first original, Kevin Spacey, let's watch it, you know, Robin Wright. And you watch it. Oh, that was such a great show. And then boom, 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 they start adding more. And you'd watch the next one. Well, all of a sudden, the next year comes along. Now they have 25 series. You're like, I can't keep up with this. You know, and I don't want to keep up with it because now they're again further dividing the pie among the genres and among the styles and all this stuff, you know?
Yeah. And it really, I put a graph up on the website. It's really funny because the pay cable looks pretty static over the past 5 years. Broadcast looks very static, you know, about 148 to 146 with little variation over the last 5 years. But the online line has gone from 33 in 2014 to 160 this year. I think that growth just shows that they're doing something different. They're going for a different thing. When you think of broadcast, you think of the way that you're trying to get people to watch something, and you only it's a very limited sample size. You know, you have a limited space to provide to your audience. So that keeps your production limited to that same amount. Without the limits of time and space, you have to produce more. And you have to kind of hone in on something that's more attractive to fewer people. And I think that's a hard thing to do when you're paying as much money as you're paying. I mean, they paid, I think, close to $8 billion for 1 year of production. It's not a sustainable course of action.
And I think some of the other things, too, that are negative, and not to focus on the negative, I think the positive is, if I could touch on that really quick, I think the positive is whatever you're into, somebody's producing content for it, which is cool because you're into right. some obscure, I mean, I don't know, you're like a city planner and you want to sit there and listen to city planning stuff. You know, like there's content out there for city planning. As dry and boring as that might be to some people might just gobble it up. But on the other hand, I think we almost lose a sense of community and a sense of self. In other words, when I was a kid or when you were a kid, there were only like a handful of stations, right? Even before cable, let's say. The three networks and maybe one or two locals, and that's all you had. So when the president would address the nation at the State of the Union, ABC, NBC, and CBS would carry it. And maybe a local might even carry it. And you had no option. If you wanted to watch TV that night, you were watching the State of the Union, like, or just turn on the radio and listen to some music. But like, you had no options otherwise. Well, today there are the options are endless, and people don't listen to things like the State of the Union, or you might, you know, those things where you had millions of people watching that one major event. And now people are so divided across content and 24-hour news and all this other stuff that I think we're losing a sense of unity, in that everybody's just kind of doing their own thing and nobody's united behind anything.
It's funny you say that, because a lot of people point to the idea that, you know, television during its broadcast heyday was pulling like 20 million viewers into an episode of Friends or something like that. I think I'm exaggerating the number.
Or MASH, let's say.
Yeah, but I wanted to speak specifically about Friends, because Friends, it turned out, is one of the largest pulls in the Netflix queue. So like all of the people that watched Friends the first time around are watching Friends again. And then
I've never seen an episode.
And then, yeah. And then all these new kids that are coming out of high school are watching Friends as well. So I think Friends was going to sunset on Netflix. And Netflix did one of their soft announcements where they were going to sunset it. And there was a huge outcry. And Netflix has the numbers, so they knew that everybody was pretty serious when they said, no, don't take away my Friends. And I think they paid, I don't know, I don't know whether this is a number or just something that somebody estimated what they should pay for it. And they needed to pay like $100 million to keep it on their air.
Wow.
Just in licensing fees. So that's not even production. All this content is already produced. So somebody had come up with this number and said it would be well worth Netflix paying $100 million to keep Friends on the air, because it would keep that many subscribers happy as you produce more and more content to shore it up.
Yeah, you're not looking at what it costs to produce it. You're just looking at overall value to the company and what money it brings them.
So, you know, when they say $100 million, although everyone says, oh, that's a huge licensing fee, but you already have produced proven content where you are going out in 2018 and spending $8 billion on content that your analytics tells you will be watched and liked by a certain segment of your subscribership. But you have no real numbers behind it. You have, you know, Friends is a proven success. So it makes sense to throw $100 million at a problem like that, because why not, you know? But it's amazing, amazing numbers.
I think the other thing too that just is shocking to me is all of this stuff is funded by advertising,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, for the most part it is. And even if you look at like Android and iPhone apps, I mean, there's like millions of these things, but there's only a few that rise to the top and that people discover and use. And it's just shocking to me that, and maybe it would be like some cool research and they probably know how, but like, how is it that such small numbers of content, of apps, of blogs, of series and stuff gets so many eyeballs and can make so much money in the face of so much competition? And most of this stuff is just background noise.
Mm-hmm.
People are paying for it, you know, and people are producing it, but it's all just background noise. And, you know, everybody gets like their 1,000 viewers, you know, their few thousand subscribers and stuff. And it's like, in today's day and age, maybe that is a lot. I don't know.
But it's all about keeping people in an ecosystem, right? It's like you don't even think about Netflix. When you see Netflix, you have that comforting feeling that you know that it will be accessible to you. And whether you watch it or not, it's just that warm blanket of like, oh, I could see that if I want to. So you get lulled into the sense of security where, oh, Battle of Buster Scruggs seems like something I would like to watch. And just knowing that I could watch it whenever I want, maybe that's enough. You know what I mean? I'll watch it and I'll like it and then it'll be fine. But it's a lot more than just the actual watching of the thing. You said that advertisers are driving and paying for all of this. In the broader sense of the internet, definitely ads is the huge payer of what's going on. But in this media space that we're talking about, this online space is only subsidized by ads, you know, and Netflix not at all, right? There's no advertising within Netflix.
Yeah, Yeah, true. It's subscription-based.
So it's subscription-based, but the real fuel to the online, over-the-top box streaming services is Wall Street. So the idea that Wall Street has leveraged their bet and just continued to lay dollar upon dollar chasing the idea that Netflix is onto something, there's got to be a sense of when are we going to reap a return from this, whether it's Hulu, whether it's Netflix, whether it's Amazon. And it feels like Amazon could outlast them all, you know? They do their media service as a secondary thing to the service that they provide to us, you know, at Christmas time, delivering us stuff for 2 days, you know, because we want Prime, you know? It's like a secondary thing for them. And it's like they're not even flexing their muscles and they're competing, you know, with somebody like Netflix, where Netflix, that's the only thing that they do.
I mean, and you're right. I mean, when you talk about subsidies, I mean, I don't know how many households have Netflix, like 50 million maybe?
Yeah. And then how many?
I mean, at $11 a month?
And how many people have Amazon Prime and don't watch any of the videos? You know what I mean? Don't watch any Prime video, you know?
Well, and the thing about Amazon, not only are they making it on that $11 a month, let's say, or whatever it costs, I think it's about that. Not only are they making the subscription cost, but they're still making profits on sales of goods. Yeah, I mean, and other services right. that they have, some of the enterprise services and things.
Oh, they make tons of money on AWS. Yeah, for sure. That's probably their biggest cash cow.
Yeah, and when you look at Netflix, I mean, you're looking at $11 a month for streaming. I don't know if anybody does the DVDs anymore, but...
I do.
Through Netflix?
Oh, no. I know a couple of people that still do the DVDs from Netflix.
We did up until about a year ago. And that's around the time, you know, that we slowed down with that. Just we don't have time. You know, there's so much in streaming that it's like, whatever, you know. And
But I still buy DVDs.
Okay.
You know, if it's a movie that I know the kids will watch over and over again.
Oh, I follow you. Yeah, we do too. Like, you know, especially when they're like 4 or 5 years old, they want to watch Ice Age 1,000 times.
And what happens if the license runs out on your favorite streaming service? Have you had that happen yet?
No.
Okay, well, it's happened, and it's the worst thing in the world.
Well, let me rephrase that. Yes, it's happened, but no, it hasn't been a problem because we were able to divert their attention to something different.
Okay.
They adapt well, believe it or not. So,
cool.
Just a general summary, I think, is there's so much content out there. Like, and I'll leave it at this. You know, we were watching The Walking Dead for all these years and stuff, you know, and what is it, 12th, 13th, 14th season or something ridiculous? I don't even know where it is. 11? I don't even know what it is. But all these seasons, you know, and it's like, you know what? I get it. There's zombies and, like, there's bad people. Like, let's move on to something new. There's so much out there. I don't want to just continue to get bogged down by this old show.
Did you hear they're doing 2 movie spinoffs?
No, I didn't.
They're doing 2 movie spinoffs of Walking Dead, and everybody's like, enough already.
And it's not just The Walking Dead. I mean, it could be any of these shows. Like, you know, I was watching, you know, Clarissa and I were watching House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, you know, and after a while, you're just like, all right, you know, like, I get it. They're still in prison. Like, I see the hijinks that happen, you know? It's like, let's just move on. New content, new shows, put these old ones to rest. There's just so much content. We don't need these old shows around anymore. Our attention is drawn in too many directions over too many things to the extent that I still like to read, and it's even hard to find time to read. Enough said.
That is a good place to leave it. We will definitely have more to say, and it is definitely an interesting space, and I hope you get a chance to look at the couple of graphs that I threw up there for us.
Cool. I'm looking forward to it. I want to check it out after
awesome.
This. All right, Ted. Well, speaking of all this content, it's 11. I might go catch some of it before it gets too late. You know, I got, hey, with 595 shows, I got to get caught up.
495.
Oh, 495
still,
shows.
A lot.
I got to get
a lot.
Yeah. Well, hey, you just took 100 off my plate.
Good. All right. Have a great night.
Yeah, you too. We'll catch you next week.
Bye.
All right. Later.
Next week, join Jim and Ted as they disarm another Hollywood bomb or marketing masterpiece. Remember, the holy trinity of podcasting. Subscribe, like, share.
Special thanks to Jeremy Kent Jackson for the voiceover and Rahelio for the music.